True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents, a tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015, an environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for what?
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates on this case and conversations as we have them. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Today, we're going to be talking with former U.S. Secret Service agent and investigative consultant Jim Rathman. Jim has a lot of insight that he can give us into the mind of someone like this and into the processes that may be going on behind the scenes as we wait now for June 26th and the next hearing. One of the things, Jim, that I want to address first, and thank you for joining us, is the amount of chatter online that seems to be going on, and in my opinion, I would say inappropriately, about the parents of Brian Koberger. These are people who also, in many ways, lost a son. It's easy to stand on the sideline and judge and assume, well, they must have known this or they must have known that. The scary thing is, in a lot of cases, the parents honestly had no idea what their son is up to. There may be inklings that there's something a little bit off, but as far as the great details, it's usually something that a killer would hide from their parents, and their parents would be somewhat oblivious to. With the criticism that's going on online, but also with the FBI and investigators doing their due diligence to find out what they knew and when, what exactly would be going on in the investigation regarding them?
Well, I mean, they're definitely going to look into the parents because they have to at this point. I mean, the father was driving with the son all the way across the country. What kind of communications were there? What email exchanges, text messages, phone calls? They're going to look into the history of it to see if the parents knew anything. I think the parents may have known that their son is quite odd. It was just a different bird, the way he was behaving, from his time in high school being bullied on and all the way up into where he's at now. I'm sure they had some indications that things were not completely stable with him mentally. But in my opinion, I don't think they would have known that he was going to commit a crime such as this. I feel for them because the whole world is going to be looking at them as being something of what Koberger had done, the son. I don't believe they would have had any knowledge or prior that he was going to commit anything like this. I just think it's, they're going to take a beating and from the media, from all the people across the world. And I feel for them. They're in a really tough spot. I mean, they're grieving their own child at this point, who they're probably never going to be able to spend time with again. At the same time, they feel bad for the victim's family. So they're really in a tough spot.
I agree. I 100% agree. There was an interesting piece that came out earlier today from Nancy Grace, who spoke with one of Koberger's neighbors. And they had a conversation. This was between the time of the murders happening and him being arrested. It was speaking about when Koberger first found a place to live in Pullman, Washington. And right. The father came out and helped him kind of get situated and such. And a lot of people, number one, questioning that, saying, why would he do that? It's a dad thing. A lot of dads actually do that. And it's not really all that odd to do. But the dad went to the neighbors and apparently said something to the effect of, hey, if you could try and be his friend, it would be helpful. Something of that nature.
Right.
Which is not necessarily something a dad would be saying of a healthy child, adult child.
Right.
Thoughts on that, of the father kind of having that feeling. I can tell that he probably did. But again, nowhere near knowing that his son was capable of all these things.
Well, I think he probably knew his son was somewhat of an introvert, being that what has happened with his upbringing, from being heavy to losing all that weight, being picked on and so mm-hmm. on, probably knew that getting friends was a little bit of a struggle. Mm-hmm. Therefore, with him and his experience throughout life, he's probably more open and willing to engage other people to communicate and for that dialogue. So probably was just saying, hey, listen, you know, my son's new here. Do you mind being friends with him? And trying to kind of make that connection to try to help his son out on the right foot in a new city, in a new location. And, you know, I can speak from my own experience. You know, I have a son that's a teenager that was a little bit shy, and I've had to try to bridge that gap in the beginning to kind of get him out of that shyness. So, but then again, it's a teenager to a grown man that's 28 years old. I know there's a difference there, but I don't fault the father for at least trying that, trying to get him a friend, trying to have him have some sort of outreach, some sort of support being all the way across the country.
I mean, even though the son is older, a dad's still going to be a dad. It is the correct way I look at it. No matter how old your kids are, you're still going to want them to be happy and have friends and all of that. When we start to look at what's going to be going on here with the prosecution of Koberger and also the defense of Koberger, his writings that we've seen online all the way from the more current day seeming Papa Roger comments to the DeSalle University questions that were asked to the writings of 2010 and 2011, where he seemed to start to notice there was a break in his emotional state, a break in understanding how others felt, and he really didn't know what was going on. Do you feel that they're going to be looking back into his past, into his history, as part of his defense to try and explain the individual that he became? And obviously not necessarily saying he became this and he's a murderer, but more so, well, these things happen and this is what makes him odd, but it doesn't make him necessarily a murderer.
I think both sides are going to dig into his past. I think it's important for the prosecution to dig into his past because you're trying to lay the foundation out for premeditation and what his psyche was and what he was trying to do and how he was trying to figure out how criminals think. How do you get away with crimes? You know, he knew to turn his cell phone off. He, you know, just trying to always stay one step ahead of law enforcement. And so it's going to show for a prosecution that this was premeditated. He thought about this for a while and it's going to help their case. At the same time, the defense team has to put together a defense for him. Now, whether we agree with what the criminal defense is going to do or not, you got to understand that defense attorneys are going to try to poke holes. That is their job. We are all entitled to a fair trial, and we're also entitled to competent attorneys and defense teams, right? So they're going to go ahead and try to make it look like, no, that's not premeditation. He was trying to get his paper here. He's trying to get a good grade. He's trying to learn. This is something that excited him, you know, when it came to law enforcement, this is where his goal was. And so they're going to try to paint this picture as the complete opposite of what the prosecution's going to do. So they're both going to dig into his past because I think it's important. It's going to be important to both sides. It's just really, what is a jury going to feel is most important? And is it really what the prosecution's going to say of what happened? Or is it going to be the criminal defense? And in my opinion, it's definitely going to go towards the way of the prosecution because we know without a doubt that he was involved with this case. He was involved with stalking them, driving by the residence, his vehicle, you know, and a lot of the evidence that was collected since then. So I think it's going to be more important for the prosecution here to be able to paint that picture for premeditation, what his mindset was leading up to it and how he was operating. But criminal defense is absolutely going to try to poke holes in it. And that is their job, is to poke holes in anything and make the burden of proof is on the state. It's on the prosecution team, and they're going to make sure the prosecution team has to do that.
And there seems to be a lot, especially with the cell phone and the pinging of the cell phone to different towers and such in the area. Some are already trying to make arguments of that, of, well, it's not so accurate. What would you say to that and how that technology actually works and how accurate that those claims are that we saw in the affidavit that was released earlier in the month?
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree that it's not accurate. I mean, it may not be able to put you within 3 feet, but it's going to put you in that general vicinity. And with him living, 15, 20 minutes away like he did in the drive, it's really hard for him to explain being on that road, being in that area, doing the 3-point turn that was caught on the video. It's his vehicle. That's really going to be problematic for the defense to try to poke holes in that the towers and the pinging it's done. It's like a triangulation that they do. It's and so they're able to figure out based on the towers and the other data and information. I don't want to share the specifics for everybody to know, because obviously I don't want to teach criminals how to break this.
Sure.
But they have a way of figuring it out. And I'll be honest with you, at times I've seen it, we can get within a couple of yards of where your suspect is actually at based on that. I mean, it can get down pretty close. So for them to say it's not accurate, I would completely and utterly disagree. Again, it's definitely going to put you on the street.
Sure. And it's that accurate. And they do have at least three towers in Moscow. We had a conversation earlier with Jennifer Coffendaffer earlier about this, because she was doing a deep dive into the cell towers as well. And it seems there certainly is enough for triangulation in the area to get a good idea about this. What about Wi-Fi connections? We've been hearing rumblings of that on and off through various news sources. Do we know anything about the fact, or the idea rather, that Koberger at some point came up on someone's Wi-Fi, or is that just pure speculation at this point?
I think that would be pure speculation, but then again, I don't know, because he would have to know what that Wi-Fi was and the password. If it was password protected, if not, then he could just access it. Something he could have done. But keep in mind, when this crime was committed, that he turned that phone off. From my understanding, that phone was not on. So I don't know exactly what Wi-Fi he would have connected to, unless it was shortly before or right after he committed the crime. So I don't really think the Wi-Fi thing holds as much weight as pinging his cell phone as he's actually traveling, putting him in that area at the time of the crime.
Let's talk about time in general. Time is obviously a very important thing to an ongoing investigation. June is our next time where the alleged suspect will be appearing before the judge. In your opinion, is time a benefit for the prosecution or the defense in something like this, or does it work either way? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it can work both ways. I mean, you know, the prosecution has plenty of time to put their case together, to make it strong, to practice it, to rehearse it, to make sure all their evidence is set to convict somebody on the charges that he, in his case, with the four murder charges. They're going to really have to paint a clear picture for the prosecution. The defense knows what's coming, and so they have plenty of time to try to poke holes in the defense, try to find where there are some loopholes, try to find out where law enforcement made some mistakes. You know, as it goes through this process, through the court process, you have the motion to suppress evidence and preliminary hearings and things like that. So basically, the defense team is going to get a free shot at what type of evidence the prosecution actually has, and that is how the process works. So they will hear the motion to suppress evidence. The defense will try to get some things thrown out, but it's a free shot to hear exactly what the prosecution has. So as the longer this goes on, the longer it takes, it could benefit both. I don't think it's going to hinder either side. You know, I think if anything, it's going to upset the public more than anything else, because they're going to want to see this go to trial. They're going to want to see this, you know, have an end solution, if they're the conviction, the sentencing, and so on. And the family needs that as well for the closure. But again, much like the investigation itself, you don't want to rush the court process, because you can't do double jeopardy here. So you only got one shot at this. So you either get it right or you're going to get it wrong. And, you know, the prosecutor is not going to want to get this wrong, because he can't retry him. So you can't rush this one.
Sure. Very, very true. When it comes to, obviously, the public's patience, and it really, public's patience has nothing to do with handling this case or prosecuting him, but it certainly is a factor on the outside looking in. In the next handful of months here, while we're waiting for this to get to that next phase, what type of information, obviously beyond the gag order, nothing's going to be coming out that way, but what sort of things do you foresee coming out to the public's awareness between now and then about this case?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of his history coming out. I think you're going to see people coming forward that were friends with him at his various colleges. See if there's any ex-girlfriends that come about. What the teacher's comments are about him. I think there's going to be a lot that comes out that's going to paint a picture of who he was and his demeanor. I think that's something we're going to see a lot of. I think there'll be some information that will come out case pertaining, but with the gag order in place, there's probably not going to be a whole lot of concrete information, concrete evidence, like something super solid that the public's going to get to know about because of the gag order that's in place. And then being able to, you know, and I think everybody's just going to have to kind of wait for the trial to really see what all took place, what truly was the DNA that they got, where exactly they got it from, which victim had what, whether there was something under a fingernail, whether there was a drop of mixed blood somewhere, other than the little stuff that was in the affidavit that we already know about. You know, what was the FBI's involvement in this? What did all of the FBI find? What was it that was so unique when they did the surveillance for 4 days? The only thing that I've heard in the public was the surgical gloves and the meticulous cleaning of his vehicle. So did he have that weapon inside that vehicle? There's certain things that are going to come out in time, and we're going to figure out exactly why law enforcement took the steps that they did. And I think that'll be really interesting. But I don't think we're going to get a lot of those concrete details, because they're not going to want to give all the information out there to the public, because you don't want to taint the jury pool. You know, at this point, they want to be able to have a fair trial. So when they get this conviction, it sticks. It's not something that can be challenged on appeal to have to redo it all over again because of somebody's awareness prior to it. I think it's going to be hard anyway to find a jury pool that hasn't heard about this case, but maybe you can find some people that don't know all the specifics.
When it comes to this, the likelihood of this trial taking place in Moscow, Idaho, what is your thoughts on that?
That's a good question. I would suspect that they're going to prosecute this in Moscow. I don't know where they're going to get the jury from on this. But I would at least think that's where it's going to be held, unless they move it to a different venue. But, you know, this has been a national news and international news now for quite some time. So I think it's going to be a challenge to really find the jury members that are needed to select for the selection on this that don't already have a thought process as to one way or another and what they think of this case. So I think that's going to be a definite challenge to find those jury members.
When one is trying to find jury members like that, and that is going to definitely be a challenge, what would be dismissive grounds for something like that? Just being aware that the case exists, or would it be having an opinion that one is speaking about? I'm just trying to get an understanding of how they're going to find someone competent, honestly, to be on a jury that wouldn't have some knowledge of this case or have developed an opinion.
Right. Typically, they want to find people that don't have all the knowledge on this case. They may have heard of it, but they don't know the specifics. They're kind of, you know, just haven't been focused on it or hyper-focused on it. The people they're not going to want are the ones that know every single detail, every single step, and they're basically have already had conversations with other people where this person's guilty or not guilty and so on. Of course, if they're guilty, obviously that would make the case for the prosecution, but it doesn't make it fair and impartial. So, you know, it's going to be such a challenge to find somebody that truly just has been in space, so to speak, that doesn't know anything about this, especially in that town or in that state. It's going to be really difficult, but you'll be surprised. But yeah, anybody that has that predetermined outcome of what happened and knows every single step of this case and been following it, those are the ones that won't be on the jury.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this timeline. We have the preliminary hearing, which is next, which is like the mini trial. They come out both sides swinging, saying this or that. After the preliminary hearing is when he is able to plead if the judge decides to move this up to another level of court, correct?
Correct. So basically what's going to happen, you do the preliminary hearing and then after that, it's going to be a motion to suppress any kind of evidence. And they do that. It's basically a free shot for the defense team because the prosecution has to show their cards. They can't just go into this case. They can't go into the trial with a complete blindsided approach that doesn't allow the defense to have some sort of defense for their client. So they're going to go into court. They're going to do this preliminary hearing. There's going to be some information that comes out of that. And at that point, the defense team is really going to have to talk to Mr. Koberger and really find out, you know, how do you want to move forward with this? Because it's either we can beat this or we don't have a shot. Let's start working on a plea deal. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And I'm sure if there is going to be a plea deal, they're going to want a complete full confession as to exactly how he did it, what he did, why he did it. Mm-hmm. So that way you're linking your actual criminal, the person who committed these murders, to specific information that only law enforcement knows about when it comes to the crime. And once they can prove that, or he's able to give that type of confession on any type of plea deal, then that will seal his fate forever.
Jim, I'm probably going to ask you this question several times over the next couple of months. Once we get to that point of him making a plea, what do you foresee happening? Guilty, not guilty, some sort of a deal?
Well, he's going to say he's not guilty up until the point where they get past the preliminary hearing and the motion to suppress any type of evidence. It's going to be after you get past that point, because if he were to come out and plead now, then you're not even hearing if there's anything as his legal defense team. They're not going to allow him to say that he's guilty if that's something route that he wants to go. They're going to continuously go with the not guilty to hear exactly what the prosecution has, see if there's anything that was, you know, any type of loopholes, any type of misconduct, any type of violations that took place to be able to get that evidence thrown out. Because then that way they'd be doing their job for Mr. Koberger. So I think that he's going to stay on that not guilty path until we get past that point. And then from there, I think he's going to end up pleading. I don't think he's going to want to go to trial on this. If the evidence is that strong, which I believe law enforcement has, he's going to have a really tough fight on his hands. And so you can plead to either spare your life or you're going to go to trial on this, get convicted, and then they're going to sentence you to death. And then, you know, you're looking at, what, 10 years, 12 years plus of appeals and the process before they can sentence or actually put him to death. So it's, you know, do you want to plead and get this over with, or are we going to have a long battle for years and years and years to go and keep taking up more taxpayer money and making it?
Jim Rathman, former U.S. Secret Service agent and investigative consultant, thank you again for joining us. If you like the program, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts as to not miss any breaking updates and discussions on the case. You can get a commercial-free experience through Apple Podcasts. Even try that for 3 days free right now if you like. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening to another edition of the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed for one.